Hello and welcome back. It is the last day of Build. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Build Edition 2016. We're excited to be here. And I have a really special guest today, the incomparable Jeffrey Snowberg. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
You were just telling me that you didn't have to do any talks this time.
No, there's not have to. I love to do talks.
But
yeah, we decided we'd have one of our PMs do the talk this year.
And you got to wander around and actually just talk to people. You said it was probably the most productive thing. Why?
Yeah, well, because basically when I usually give a talk, right, I spend a lot of energy on that, and I'm paying attention to the demos, making sure that they work. Yesterday, I just went around talking to customers about what they're doing, what their concerns were, how we could do a better job. And I tell you, I got this nice list of actionable things that I can go do. I got to tell you, this has been the most productive Build I've ever had.
That's kind of cool.
I did not anticipate that.
So I will tell you, just as on a personal side, last year, very first Build for me, right? This man, I interviewed him the first, my very first Build interview.
I think that went really well.
He's nice. I think we have some embarrassing footage. Let's roll the videotape, G.
Let's go back to Build.
Build, yes.
And the last time you did an interview on the Channel 9 Live stage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's give everybody watching at home, show them what happened.
What kind of things can you do with PowerShell?
PowerShell.
Yeah, what you can't, I don't know that there's anything you can't do.
So what are the kinds of things you can do with PowerShell? Maybe a better question is, what are the things you can't do? Let's start with what you can.
I apologize for the new guy.
I picked right up on that.
Yeah.
Turns out you didn't need to tell me that. I already knew.
Yeah. Welcome to Channel 9, Seth. By the way, I have done some PowerShell.
That's good.
FYI, I built a build script using Saki and PowerShell.
Isn't Saki cool?
To automate my, so I've repented, okay? So
I atoned.
Yeah, I've atoned for that. And so let's start with PowerShell.
Okay.
Because there's been some interesting announcements with Bash on Windows.
Yeah.
Does that mean that we no longer need PowerShell? Let's start there.
No. We're investing heavily in PowerShell. We'll continue to invest heavily in PowerShell. PowerShell has a great future. Super friendly to the Bash stuff, too. So basically, here's what happened. You know, a lot of developers are developing for multiple environments. They manage, do stuff for Windows, they do stuff for Linux. And what they found is that the workflow of developing for Linux servers on the Windows was difficult.
Right.
Okay. And so what the Bash is all about is for those developers who are developing open source software for Linux targeted stuff, Windows is going to be a great environment. They loved it. It just said, hey, it's kind of awkward. The tools don't have the right semantics. You know, I bring some of these Linux emulation stuff. It doesn't quite fit. So now when you run Bash, you are in Linux. So I don't think that was clear. You're in Linux, like real Linux, and then you go and you do anything, and it's got the real tools in it. Now, from Bash, it's two worlds, right? The streams don't cross.
Right.
So when you're in Bash, you can't run Notepad.
Right.
And when you're in command.exe or PowerShell, you can't run awk. So it's really focused in on developers. But anyway, so PowerShell, boy, I don't know if you've taken a look at PowerShell version 5. Crazy amount of investment, crazy progress there. And I'll tell you, we've spent a lot of time on our engineering system. Now, that's a boring detail, engineering system.
Yeah, but we're engineers, man. We want to hear the boringness. That's
seriously
what we live for, yes.
Okay, well, I was just going to give you the net. But the boringness is, what we've done is we've taken all of our code and we've moved it to a Git repository.
Okay.
And so now we're building out of the Git repository. What that means is that we can be much more agile and take contributions from anywhere in the company far easier. So here's what that really means is, you like the progress you've seen so far in PowerShell? That's about to accelerate. You know, we're about to pour gasoline on that fire.
Nice.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, right? Because the thing I've learned over the year in PowerShell is that it literally takes what I used to do on the command line with batch files, and it augments it with the awesome sort of power of the namespaces in .NET.
Yeah.
So you can do some really cool things.
Well, in fact, that's my favorite part about PowerShell version 5, and so appropriate for build.
Right.
Okay, so PowerShell, if you actually read the Monad Manifesto, wrote a manifesto, and what I said was, you know, we have a problem in the industry. The tools that our operators use are different than the tools our developers use.
Right.
And so when one team gets in trouble, they can't really talk to one another. And so we now call this DevOps, by the way.
Okay,
we now have
a term
for it. But I said what I wanted PowerShell to do was to be that language that bridge these two communities. So that's explicitly the goal. And so we wanted to have something that could be nice, loose, ad hoc, very quick and dirty, or be able to do systems programmings with. Well, in reality, the first few versions of PowerShell, we were very focused in on the operations and the coverage, command coverage.
Right.
With PowerShell version 5, we take a big shift there. And we say, hey, we're going to get really serious about the developers. So now in PowerShell version 5, like, are you seated? Does that have
a
seatbelt?
Yeah, I'm sitting down. Tape me down, people.
Does that have a seatbelt?
I'm ready.
Okay. So in PowerShell version 5, you can implement .NET classes. Like implement .NET classes.
Oh my goodness.
So you say, oh, here's this .NET base class. I can subclass that in PowerShell. I can implement interfaces in PowerShell. I can have inheritance in PowerShell. And so now developers, because it turned out one of our teams had been using PowerShell as an integration platform. And so then they go to people and say, hey, write scripts that look like this. And sometimes that works and sometimes people got it wrong. And so what they found, it was a much more natural way to express a contract through a class.
Of course.
So they said, hey, go implement this class in PowerShell. And then that they did the right thing. And
that's pretty cool. So it feels like, because this, and we've had conversations about this before, the DevOps space feels very nebulous to me. And to me, DevOps has literally become powerful PowerShell scripts that take the code that I write, run the tests, make sure that it works, builds a NuGet package, does all sorts of things just on my behalf.
Yeah, well, now you're getting me excited. Okay, so here's the thing. Can we talk about Windows Server 2016?
Absolutely, I want to do that.
Okay, so the big story about Windows Server 2016 is that what I've done is I've now resolved the interface between devs and operators in the OS. What's that mean?
I know. It feels like we still want to have arguments with the IT people, though, from the dev side.
Well,
Are you taking that away from us?
I'm going to make it a constructive argument.
Nice, thank you.
So here's what happened. In the past, basically, you know, Windows, amazingly successful operating system, we produced a set of APIs and said, you know, good luck, right? And so then there's a set of artifacts that got generated and different people did things different ways. We did not take an architectural stand on a set of key issues that really made it set up conflict between our developers and our operators.
Sure.
So now I resolve that. So in Windows Server 2016, now we take a point of view about how you should install and package your code, right? That there is a clear separation between the installation of your code and your configuration. By the way, installation, we have a new packaging format called WSA, Windows Server Applications.
Interesting.
It's basically AppX for server. I mean, it's literally AppX for server. We just took AppX, extended it, and made it friendly to servers. Then we said we're going to start off with a very small server, nano server. We've got to talk about that.
Yes, we will.
It's like 440 megabytes.
It's on my list.
Okay, and then you can add the components that you want. So we decided defined how to have repositories and bring in the software you want. So packages, repositories, configuration, desired state configuration. When you make a change, you want to test it, pester unit testing.
Yes.
And when you you want to secure it so that not everyone's an admin, so just enough administration, GIA. So now we have defined these artifacts and we're telling the industry, hey, go, when you write your software, produce these artifacts and you will smooth out the interface between your developers and operators and flow.
That's interesting because I'm so glad that there's people like you that are saying to developers and to operators, we know that you need to bridge that gap and we keep talking about bridging it, but here's some really good guidance and we'll put it into our systems.
You know, if you talk to the DevOps community, they often talk about, they'll say, this is not a technology thing. And that's largely right. You know, it is, the higher order bit is culture and mindset. But there's a lot of technology to it, too.
Thank you. And I have talked to a lot of DevOps people, and they go, it's people, process, and then some other P that I forget, right? People, process, and something P, right? And I'm like, but wait a minute.
Help us.
I need to actually do something with technical
code.
stuff.
code.
Right? I need to write code. I need to actually get this stuff out there. I understand that you're agnostic, but can you give me some guidance?
Some right? help.
Yeah, some help.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad we're doing that. Why don't we explain a little bit why the WSA installers are sort of better than the standard MSI installers?
Yeah, so basically MSI tried to be declarative, and then they said, and if you need to, there's this action. Mm-hmm. And that is the portal to hell.
Yeah.
Because basically what that means is it's very difficult to do things like offline installation. You can't do servicing. So AppX is a purely declarative way of installing something. You can install it. You can clean up from it. You can then say, I'm going to install it offline. I'm going to service it offline. And so what we did was we said, great foundation. We need a slightly different model for server. So first off, we don't want things compartmentalized.
Right.
We want them to be full trust. And we need to do things like set up services and register WMI providers. So that's all we did, was we just extended it for those types of extensions.
That's cool, because as you said, AppX really lives in this container of the store, and then there's special trust that you get that's not going to write services, that's not going to do some of that stuff. All right, so we're going to get to some questions.
Oh, yay.
Does this mean Microsoft is reviving the subsystem architecture? First of all, explain to me what that is, and then maybe the answer.
Sure. So basically, the subsystem architecture, NT, the original NT, was a microkernel. And the idea was that you could have various subsystems. Now, a subsystem is something that implements the kernel APIs.
I see.
Okay. So when you transition from user space to kernel space, a subsystem handles that and works in elevated mode. And the idea was that, well, you could have the Windows Win32 subsystem, or you could have the OS2 subsystem,
and I read that.
Or the POSIX subsystem. If you recall, there was services for Unix. That was a POSIX subsystem. Okay, so that sort of fell into disfavor as we focused in on the Win32 subsystem. We stopped shipping the POSIX subsystem, but that infrastructure for subsystem remained, and that is what we're using. I don't think that means you're going to see a ton of subsystems come up. It turned out that as you try and integrate the various, to produce a coherent subsystem of elements of, coherent experience of elements of different subsystems turned out to be a big challenge, right? So with the services for Unix, right? So that I don't know if you know, that was the history of PowerShell.
Cool.
Is originally, didn't want to invent anything. Just said, hey, there's a bunch of great tools out there, these Unix tools, let's just bring those Unix tools on Windows and job over, and we'll go do something else. Mm-hmm. So we did that. We took services for Unix, brought it on Windows, and it turns out it didn't solve anything.
Right.
Because there was no Etsy password, there was no Etsy group, and then it all works on a document-oriented system. Anyway, so, it didn't quite solve the problem. And that's why when we did it this time, Bash is its own isolated world, which has perfect fidelity, and it runs just great.
And it's not Cygwin on Windows. That's not what it is.
No, that's sort of that merged world that people had found difficulties. Like, it's almost
the right thing.
The right thing, but not quite. And that almost caused hiccups in the developer flow.
Sure.
And we're focused in on having a nice, smooth developer flow.
All right, next question. This is a hard one. And so I'll start with, this question speaks to how much PowerShell sort of has taken, like, wow, we really want this. Any chance that PowerShell will be ported over to Linux? This is the Mary Jo question that she always pesters you about, not just DSC support, and or that it will hop on the Microsoft open source.
Well, I will tell you that there's been an incredible amount of interest in PowerShell on Linux. In fact, the very first, when I started off with Monad, we once had a big financial bank come to me, and the guy was a Windows guy, and he says, you got to talk to my boss. He's just all about this Linux. You got to convince him that this stuff's good stuff. And so I said, okay, had a meeting with him, and start to explain, well, look, here's the Unix model, and here's where I think we could do better. And the guy's like all in my face, like, you're wrong. I said, okay, well.
Okay, all right.
And he said, well, you're wrong. I said, well, after a little bit of this, I said, you know what, we just disagree. So if you want, I can save you 45 minutes, and we can end the conversation. But if you don't, if you want to hear, I'll explain why we think we can do a better job. So he says, okay, fine, sorry, I'll just listen. At the end of 45 minutes, he had one question. What's this written in? I said, C#. big scowl. I said, well, that seems like a problem. Why is it a problem? He says, this should be written in C++, because this is the greatest thing ever. I want my Unix guys to use this. I want my Windows guys to use this. I want this to be everywhere. So even at the very beginning, there had been a strong demand for it to be a universal shell. The problem was that it was .NET, and .NET did not exist on other environments. And now it does.
Kind of, yeah.
And I'm not announcing anything today.
Right, very good.
Yeah.
Good
question. So I just thought you'd like that little backstory.
Yeah, you know, and I
don't think I've ever told that story.
No, and here's the thing, like, I had obviously seen PowerShell before I talked to you last year, and then when I was embarrassed, as you everyone saw at the beginning, let me take a look at this. I started looking at it. It seemed like a really nice way to automate the dumb things I always did.
Yeah.
But with the added benefit as a programmer of reaching into .NET and doing stuff with that how I usually like. So I like it. All right, so Alan asks, how big is the difference between APEX and WSA? Will they evolve together or are they separate? You kind of mentioned a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, they're this. Think of it as a subclass. We're, you know, WSA subclasses APEX. And so we add things like WMI providers, subsystem registration. I think there's a couple other things, and that we run in full trust applications, which is to say, you know, with WSA, you install something, but then if I log into the machine, I don't see what you did. That's yours. That's not how you do it in servers. You know, if you're in server, you install something, you want everybody to see it.
Of course. And, and the cool thing is I love how there's just like, it's APEX, declarative, because if there's action, there's always this dialogue box that you go away, you want everything to install, and you show up the next morning hoping it's installed, and you have to click OK here to continue. It's like, oh man, I just wasted. So that sort of does away with that weirdness.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
So now let's move on, because we have about maybe 13 minutes, so please come with your questions. Let's move on to Azure Stack.
Yeah,
and
crazy.
And this is a, I want to understand this because I think it's quite revolutionary the way we've made a cloud service not be so cloudy, but sometimes can be if you want. Tell us about that.
Well, basically, it starts from our belief, our strong belief or knowledge, that the cloud is a model, not a place. Okay? And so it turns out as we had conversations with customers, a lot of them, in fact, just on the way over, got coffee down the road, and a guy's like, oh, I'm coming to see your talk. And he's so excited about Azure Stack. He said, well, why are you so excited? He says, well, everybody loves the Azure deployment model. They love the programming model, but they're not ready to, they're just not ready to go take all their data and put it in the cloud. Like, it might be fine. It sort of probably is fine, but
we're not sure.
But we're not sure. Yeah. So Azure Stack allows them to say, great, I'm going to take the Azure model, the cloud model, and I'm now going to run it on my servers in my data centers. And so it's just a wonderful model. And the thing I love about it most is that it gives the customer the right to be wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And by that, I mean, you know, if you don't put everything in the public cloud and it turns out that you were wrong, that was the wrong thing for whatever reason, you got some big drama.
Right.
You put it all in the private cloud and you're like, no, you know, really, to be agile, I should have put it in the public cloud. That's some drama. And with us, it's like there's no drama. It's the same model.
So let me see if I understand. Let's just say I have a server rack with a couple of computers.
Yeah.
Is there a specification that says this is how you should build your rack if you're going to use Azure Stack?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
So from a hardware standpoint, we're taking a very a strong position. Here's the way you want to configure your hardware, the sort of a gold standard for putting together a cloud hardware system. And then we will come in with this large installer, which is a large, it's going to go bare metal provision these systems. We put all the software on there. We configure all that. So we do all that for you, and that's part of the value of it.
So it's
not a doc.
And that's crazy because, like, usually a cloud provider wants to keep how they have their racks very proprietary.
Yeah.
Wants to keep how they provision their software very proprietary. Wants this knowledge to be very proprietary because usually that's the value add. But here what we're saying is, we'll give it to you. You're not comfortable with coming to the cloud? How about we bring the cloud to you first?
Exactly. And you know what's so fun is you listen to the guys who are public cloud vendors, and they will tell you all the benefits of public cloud. And they're right. And then they'll badmouth the private cloud. And they know in their heart they're lying.
Yeah.
And the private cloud guys, the guys that only have a private cloud, they'll tell you all the benefits of the private cloud. And they're right. And then they'll badmouth the public cloud. and they know they're lying,
yeah.
right? And so the reality is there are benefits to the public cloud, there are benefits to the private cloud, and there are drawbacks to both, right? So it's a mix. So what we get to do, we get to be the honest broker. Uh-huh. We get to have that honest conversation about, yes, you know, you can go either way. Let's talk about what the pros and cons are for you and your circumstances, and then together we can figure out the right thing. And again, if something changes, no drama, we'll do the other thing.
And that's kind of cool because does this enable, and maybe this is a good question, does this enable people to be in a hybrid situation where they have some of their stuff on the private cloud, some of the stuff on the public cloud? Can they do that? And if they do, how do these things sort of talk to each other?
No, that's exactly right. You can. In fact, Igor Sedenkin gave a talk on that here. So you should check out Channel 9, Igor Sedenkin. I think it's called Hybrid Applications for the Azure Stack.
There you go.
And he told you, you know, all the use cases and then how to do it.
Awesome. All right. So let's yeah. some more.
By the way, it was overflowing. People are just dying to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer. I have a friend that works in New York, and they do specialized stuff that has to be. So they have their own special only internal network ring where only certain people can go in the door, and only stuff works in there. There are situations where there's certain kinds of data that just needs to be there.
Yep.
But they love the sort of the Azure model.
Yeah.
You can have both.
Yep.
And so that's kind of cool. All right, so some questions, which I think will help transition us to the next topic, because I love the Azure Stack topic. From Johnny, with Nano Server, you could have Azure Stack in it, so more on-premise use for Nano Server?
Yeah, indeed. If you think about Nano Server, what we've said is we're starting off version one with two use cases, scenarios. First is Cloud OS infrastructure. So it supports Hyper-V clusters, storage clusters, DNS, works great there. The second is born in the cloud applications, right? So we're getting all the great language runtimes. We got .NET Core, and you can build fantastic cloud applications using Nano Server.
So let's transition now in the last sort of third of our talk to Nano Server. What was the genesis of Nano Server? And then let's talk about some of the benefits, because I saw some performance stuff, and it's mind-boggling how much better it is. Even though it's simpler, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so basically we wanted to say, as you go talk to people doing the cloud, right, what they said was, hey, we reboots are a big issue,
yeah,
right? And size is a big issue, right? We want to have maximal effectiveness, we want to have maximal resources for the application versus the OS, and we want to be fast, okay? So basically, all the signals that we're getting made us say, you know, it's time to really do a dramatic refactoring of the server. So what we did was we got rid of the GUI stack. Now here's the thing. Like if you're a small business and there's your server, there's the monitor, there's the keyboard, there's the box, we have server and a desktop that continues to exist, and that's a fantastic option.
Sure.
It really is. But when you say, hey, I got tens of thousands of things, right? Bing, mm-hmm. Office, they have large numbers. Having a GUI stack, they never use that GUI stack.
No.
And yet they got to provision it, they got to move it, et cetera. So what we did was we dramatically refactored the OS. We got rid of the GUI stack, we got rid of 32-bit support, and we got rid of side-by-side. And now we've got this incredibly small, it's about 440 megabytes right now.
Which is crazy.
Oh, get this. On a Gen 2 VM, it starts up in like 2.5 seconds. I started something saying like, well, what happened there? Well, it started. Like, what? I said, here, let me show you. Shut it down. Start it again. Like, what happened?
It started, yeah. Then it shut down. That's amazing.
Yeah, and you do all remote management, mm-hmm. and so we're doing a great job on the remote management. And then this is where that packaging story comes in.
I see. 'Cause
you say, well, it's the base components, but now I want to add IIS. Oh, you can go and you can pull it down from the cloud or an internal repository. Oh, I'd like to add Hyper-V. Pull it down.
That's awesome, because it's like, I don't know, as developers, when we're building stuff, like let's just say Visual Studio now. When you install it, you can install the bare metal on the newest versions that are coming out soon. And then you can just add stuff as you go.
Yes.
And it comes from this place, and you mentioned something about cattle. And maybe you can talk about why sort of this cattle analogy works when we have these kinds of servers.
Yeah, so basically this is the idea of like pets versus cattle, right? Yeah. So in the past, you'd treat your servers like pets, right?
Yeah.
You give them precious names, yeah. Fluffy, you'd treat them very carefully. If they got sick, you'd call in a vet and worry yeah. about it. Whereas with cattle, you don't do that, right? Cattle, you give them numbers. If something goes wrong, you know, you don't worry about it. You just fire up the barbecue yeah. and you just like nice. Just take the drama out of it. Right. Now, what was interesting was I was describing this to someone and they said, oh, so with containers, it's not even cattle, it's chickens.
Yeah.
Because there are so many,
yeah.
you don't name chicken, you don't number chickens.
Yeah.
You say, I got a bunch of them. So yeah, anyway, so we've gone from pets to cattle and now with containers to chicken.
And the reason why is because back in the day, when they had their one server or yeah. maybe two at most, if it went down, you were literally down.
Exactly, right. And so now it's more of a mass management, right? It's about managing a large collection of systems, not a system. And that's, by the way, why people are able to, you know, what excites me the most is that as an industry, we finally are figuring out, we're finally decoding how to take technology and drive the business forward.
Right.
You know, in the past, I talked to people a lot about, and a lot of the conversation was, I could save you money. I can save you money. Well, you know what? Here's the thing about saving money. Awesome. Love it.
Yes.
We're always going to do that. There's a maximal amount of money that I can save you, whatever you're spending.
Yeah.
But in terms of helping you earn money, there is no cap on how much I can help you
it's
earn.
A good way to look at it, yeah.
And we as an industry are starting to get really good at putting large amounts of computing to drive the industry forward, to drive your business forward. And when you can do that, you can't have any friction. You gotta be able to move fast, mm-hmm. and you gotta be lightweight and agile. So, you know, it's all about being able to listen to your customer, understand what they want, write that in code, get it out there, see if it has the effect, and do it again rapidly. That's why size is so critical. That's why these management, you know, fixing this interface between the developers and the operators is so critical. Anything that interrupts that flow of listening to the customers, responding, deploying, listening, anything that interferes with that costs you money.
And you just can't compete anymore.
Exactly.
Because everyone else is doing it.
Yeah.
All right, some more questions. What is the difference between NanoServer and a container, aka Docker?
Yeah, so here's the way you think about it. You fire up Visual Studio and you decide what, you have a project. NanoServer will be a project type, okay? So that's targeting a set of APIs. So you can either target server core or NanoServer, okay? You have a different set of APIs.
Sure.
Some that have GUIs, some that don't. Then you get an XE. Once you have the XE, NanoServer or Server Core, you get to decide how you want to deploy it. So you can deploy either on a physical machine, into a virtual machine, or into a container, Windows Server container or Hyper-V
right.
container. So container is really just a way to run executables and says nothing about the executables. NanoServer says something about the executables.
Got it. Next one, are we likely to see Bash Shell on NanoServer?
No, you won't, because Bash Shell is focused in on developers and their desktops.
And I like how it was pretty dogmatic, right? No, and here's the reason why. NanoServer is a machine that runs Windows stuff.
Yeah.
And it's the minimal stuff that you need, not the GUI, not the other stuff. So, good.
Yeah.
All right, will Service Fabric on-prem work on NanoServer?
Service Fabric on-prem. Yes, it will.
There you go.
In fact, so we're working with that team. We got the native portions all up and running, and we're working on the managed code portions. And in fact, it was just a couple days ago, I said, hey, is it okay to tell people that at Build? And as of 3 days ago, I hadn't had an answer, and as of 2 days ago, they do. And the answer is yes, I can tell people about that. So
awesome.
Yes, Service Fabric, NanoServer, and by the way, fantastic combination.
Oh, I know.
You know, I don't know if you've seen, did you see this Age of Ascent thing?
Yes.
Is that crazy?
Like he was still playing the game while things were failing.
Oh,
it was amazing.
Well, and he's doing it in the browser. Anyway, so that's using Service Fabric and NanoServer and Core CLR and just getting phenomenal performance. I mean, it's just crazy.
Why don't you just spend briefly a couple of seconds on the speed improvements? I saw some charts. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So let's see. I'm bat it off the top of my head. Basically, so because of the reduction in size, we had like 1/10 the number of critical patches. You know, critical patches, security, you know,
yeah.
Tuesday, and the things that cause you to do a reboot. We had 1/10 the number of ones. So one, you have fewer reboots.
Right.
Two, you don't have these security vulnerabilities. The startup time went from, I think it was 400 seconds down to 90 seconds. No, you know, it was larger than that. I forget, I'll get the numbers, but it was crazy. It was like a 26 times reduction in deployment times and a 26 times reduction in size. So server and a desktop, I don't know if you saw what I did there.
No.
Sometimes we call it server with a desktop. Okay. I call it server and a desktop because it makes me sad.
Yeah. It's nice.
No, it's great for small to medium businesses, but for the cloud, you don't want to use that. But anyway, it's a great thing. It's 10 gigabytes, around 10 gigabytes. Yeah. Server core is about 5 gigabytes. Nano server, about 440 megabytes.
That's
so
amazing.
It's about 26 times smaller. And the boot speed flies like the wind. The amount of kernel memory that we consume is less than half. And we've even gone and we're measuring the number of IOs per boot, and that's significantly reducing. We continue to work on that because indeed you get a lot of them and you're all running on a VM, and you fire up the hypervisor and they're all starting. You want to minimize the number of IOs per boot so that everybody starts faster.
So you're not page faulting all over the place.
You got it. So yeah, there's I got to say, you know, my joke is, and it's sort of not a joke, is I didn't come to Microsoft because I loved Windows. I came to Microsoft because I wanted to turn Windows Server into something that I did love. Nano Server is that thing. You know, in the past, you know, I was able to make some changes, but now as the lead architect and technical fellow, we're able to do what I thought we really should do. All that stuff is great, but it should be optional. You start off small, you add the things that you want, and then there's a clear delineation, clear architecture about how to manage the system. So this is the version of Windows Server that I love. This is the one I came to do.
Well, this is great. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, the awesome Jeffrey Snover. Again, we're here at Build 2016. We'll see you on the flip side with Azure IoT. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.